work from home looks different for different people.
Yeah,
for
absolutely.
A fresher who lives with their family, if the family is supportive, great. But for somebody that does not come from a family where they are supported, being in that environment is the opposite of productive then, and it's not their fault. What happens to working women? We use our lunch break to put food on the table for the family, and then they eat within the last 10 minutes. And we're a very lonely population at the moment. We live in the age of tech. We can do anything without moving an inch, and yet we are the loneliest people. And with AI and therapy especially, it's loneliness and isolation. It's a very scary line to walk.
Welcome to your favorite voice of business psychology, the Psych and Success Podcast. I'm your host, Kritika Kashyap. Today, we have Rinelle Oliver. She is a wizard at creating thriving workplace environments and a mental health psychologist. With over 7 years under her belt, from setting up Goodwave Foundation to championing positive psychology and work-life integration, Rinelle is here to spill the beans on making workplaces genuinely inclusive, bridging generational gaps, and the impact of AI on our mental health. Rinelle's insights are gold. Let's begin the conversation. Hi, Rinelle. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast, Psych and Success.
Thank you, Kritika. I love to be here. I'm very excited to speak to you today.
Our common friend had introduced us, Chirag, and because he had mentioned a lot about the kind of work that you're doing on mental health, on well-being on people, I was very curious to connect to you and understand, you know, what got you into this world and how are you navigating through it? What excites you? And then after having a conversation with you, because the first time we talked, it actually felt like I'm talking to a friend of mine. I mean, the conversation went all around and it was so much fun. And we went on for like good 1 hour, 1.5 hour just talking. So I completely loved it. And I'm so happy that now we are finally doing this podcast. So why don't you start with introducing yourself to the listeners?
Sure. Hi, my name is Rinelle. I am a mental health psychologist. And Kritika is absolutely spot on. Our first conversation was great. I mean, we sort of really hit it off. And I know we started to talk about mental health, but ended up talking about everything else under the sun. And that's what I love about this space, the kind of people you meet. In terms of, you know, what I've done in this space and background, I completed an MSc in mental health in 2018 from the university, from Nottingham Trent University. As an international student, I mean, it was a phenomenal experience. I came back to India and worked in the mental health space ever since then. It really opened my eyes up to how it's completely different in both countries, but there's so much you can do in the space in both. I think that's what excites me about mental health and people. It's completely changing, it's evolving, and who you get to work with and the kind of impact you create, that's just what keeps us all going.
That is true. And what got you into mental health in the first place?
I think I was just incredibly curious about people and what drives them. In 2016, when I submitted my thesis for my undergraduate degree, I was an international student myself. This was in Canada. I realized the mental health challenges that I was going through. As an international student, I mean, you do get a lot of support, no doubt, but you're on your own most of the time. For yourself, what is it that you can do? I studied the relationship between gratitude and international students and understanding how positive psychology had an impact on a person's subjective well-being. That really helped because not only was I understanding what international students came in feeling, but also giving them an exercise that they could take back into their own little homes and do every single day. So we ended up doing the three things exercise, the simplest one in the book. And it did turn out that people who did this exercise religiously actually reported higher levels of subjective well-being. And for me, that was a win. I mean, I would have appreciated, you know, as an international student from day one, if I was given something really small to kind of work through. That's where it all started for me in terms
of
mental
health. So I'm intrigued about these three activities that you had suggested to international students, because a lot of students would be listening to this as well.
Sure. It's actually completely theoretically based. You can look it up if you are listening. It's called the Three Good Things Exercise, and it's a gratitude exercise. It basically invites you to list down three good things that happened to you during the day, or three things that went well. Now, keep in mind, these don't necessarily have to be three wins. So the misconception is it has to be something big and it has to be a win. Absolutely not. You can write something as simple as, the sky was blue today and I went on a great walk. So it's about recognizing the tiny things that in your day just simply go by. I think for the first couple of days myself, I kept writing, I had a great cup of coffee, because to me that's important. It set the tone for the day, and it's something I recognized within my day. But had I not done the exercise, I think I would have just had a great cup and said, oh, this is nice, and kind of moved on. But at night, when you're sitting down with your own thoughts, you are forced to think about the things that made you smile. And you write those down consistently for 3 months, 6 months, 9 months. And in a way, your brain trains itself to then look for the little good. It's a training of sorts, and it kind of invites you to really be grateful for the tiniest bits that you usually overlook. And especially now, it's not easy to do that. It's really not easy. It might seem very trivial at the start. I'll be very honest about it as well. I had participants come back and say, really, you want us to do this? So just give it a shot. For me, just do it. Just try. But if you feel that you can't and it's forced, I wouldn't continue. There's no point forcing yourself to sit down and do it. Because sometimes you're just not at that point in life where you're able to. That's the exercise.
Yeah, because when you say this, I remember, like, very recently in my coaching session that I was talking, and you know, I had gotten myself into a bit of a negative talk by the end of the day, and because I was not able to complete my filled with over expectation to-do list. And my coach, rather than talking about the to-do list, he talked about, why don't you think about what all have you achieved throughout the day? Like, you're talking about what did you like? It was rather than still on the positive side. And within a span of two, three days that I'm talking, I was just feeling a little better about myself. And that was great. You went to Canada and then you went to the UK for your studies. How was it? How was mental health has been different in these three countries that you have explored?
So I'll be very honest with you. I was an undergraduate student in Canada. So I obviously didn't have access to a lot of resources in terms of internships or jobs. You know, a mental health practitioner, because I was still very much a student and far from qualified to work in that space. I was learning. So I can't speak for mental health in Canada. UK, on the other hand, was an entirely different experience for me. I started off in 2017, and it was a research-based degree, and they encouraged you to work outside of that. So I had classes twice a week. And I was working at this organization called Leaders Unlocked, based out of London. And beautiful people, lovely place to be. They sort of crowdsourced students, university students, and trained us to create and deliver mental health workshops in schools across Nottingham and surrounding cities. It was an incredible experience, because you are in a strange country, and you're learning about the mental health landscape there, creating content for students of that country, and then going and talking about mental health. So it was an absolutely wonderful experience to meet people, to meet these students, understand where they were coming from, the kind of challenges they were facing. And they were very excited to learn or hear from somebody that was close to their age, I would say. Not exactly the same age. We were about maybe 5 to 6 years older. But the idea behind it was have young people talk to young people instead of a teacher or a lecturer or an adult speaking to a group of eighth graders. I also worked as a mental health support worker within the city of Nottingham, and I did have a roster of clients that I would see a couple of times a week. Mind you, this was not therapy at all. And as a mental health support worker, I was involved in sort of just speaking to these people, supporting their mental and physical needs. So offering support in a very real way. And often that meant going into their homes and going into their living spaces, speaking to them, because most of these people were incredibly lonely. They had mental health conditions that had been diagnosed. And while they were seeing a therapist maybe once a week, they also needed support from the community. That's where people like me stepped in and spent time with them. But you did need to have a mental health sort of background in it and some training, because these were all vulnerable cases. So supporting them in terms of maybe encouraging them to go for a walk, or understanding, you know, what they are not seeing when they can't get out of it, stuff like that. So mental health support work really opened my eyes to the other side, the real side of it.
What is the difference between mental health support worker and a therapist?
I think it's a black and white difference. And this is something I feel extremely strongly about. In order to be a therapist, you have to study to be one. You don't just become one. You have to get the right degrees, get certified in the right way. And depending on the country you live in, make sure you also get certified under that body. Anything other than that, anything below that, you can't do a 6-month
certification program
in counseling and say that, oh, I'm a therapist now, or I'm a counselor. There again, there is a difference between the two. But just please get your degrees right. At the end of the day, these are people's lives in your hand. People who are looking to you for support and guidance. And that's definitely something, an area that very passionate about, to make sure people get the right care from the most qualified person, at least.
And you came to India and you had co-founded Good Way Foundation. So tell us about that. Where did that come from?
Sure, absolutely. Good Way Foundation was a reaction to something. And I started working at a company called Never Grow Up in Feb 2020. And sometime in mid 2020, right in the, like, as soon as the pandemic sort of hit all of us, we went full steam ahead with our plans to launch our employee assistance program called Workplace Wellbeing. And it's based on the principles of positive psychology. So I'm sure you can see the connect now between love for positive psych and launching something in this space. Based on the science of happiness, Never Grow Up as a company itself is based on happiness at work. So it just fit like a glove to sort of, you know, launch something in the space of well-being. What we did here was launch three separate verticals. So we did offer counseling, that is one-to-one support, with licensed qualified therapists. Offered workshops. All these workshops were under the gamut of positive psychology. So we touched on resilience, creativity, mindfulness. The reason being, we felt that when speaking to people at work, a lot of noise and chatter has been around illness and anxiety and depression, and the words were kind of just being thrown around without with very real understanding of it, little bit. And the understanding was not great. So we said, hey, you know, instead of scaring people off, the science of happiness and positive psych as a whole is a very strengths-based approach. It's taking what you're good at, explaining that to you, and encouraging you to use those strengths.
So the workshops
were based on more strengths-based than illness-based. So instead of identifying why your teams were not doing well and saying, oh, maybe it could be because of a mental health concern, we go in the complete opposite direction and say, what are your teams good at? Let's build on that. So that was the workshop offering. And the last bit was expressive art, which involved music therapy, art therapy, and dance and movement therapy.
Right.
All three offerings, we partnered with therapists and we partnered with mental health trainers in this space who obviously came with enough experience to either deliver a workshop or obviously conduct therapy sessions with our clients.
Okay.
We launched it, and I'll be very frank with you, because of the pandemic, it's not something that kicked off. People didn't have the budgets to onboard an employee assistance partner at the time. They were trying to keep their business afloat. They were trying to keep their people afloat.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
Right? So in 2021, when Delta hit us, we realized that we had the platform, we had the tech, we had the therapist. The only thing stopping us from opening up the platform was the fact that it was a B2B platform. And that's when the director of Never Grow Up, we had a chat, we spoke with the team, and came to the conclusion that let's just open it up for free. So we dipped back into our pool of therapists and said, hey, we'd like to do this. You will get paid. We're not asking you to do this pro bono.
Okay.
Would you like to participate? It was called the 100 Hour Project. And we opened up our platform and people from all over the world booked sessions with us, with our therapists rather. And within the first 48 hours, we had 150 bookings.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Our system crashed. I took the booking.
Okay.
So,
I don't know if that's a good news or a bad news for the company. But...
great news for the company. Very bad news for me and the founder. Because at the time, I mean, people are obviously definitely trying to book more and more sessions.
Yeah.
And your system is down. But Never Grow Up on its own was also trying to keep its people afloat. We were offering only 100 hours. But when we crossed the 100, it didn't feel right to just say, okay, now we're done. But when we started to get bigger and bigger and 150, the 150 mark was hit, we couldn't afford to keep the platform running because Never Grew Up was paying for these sessions. It was not crowdsourced or crowdfunded in any capacity.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that must be a huge financial hit to the company.
Absolutely. And at that point, the business decision that was taken by the director, by Asif, was not an easy one. I mean, to run the business, try and bring in new business, keep your people afloat, and also offer 150 hours of free therapy smack in the middle of one of COVID's deadliest waves. It wasn't easy for sure, but it was worth it because people came back and said, this is what they needed. They couldn't afford therapy and they really needed this. And it was something that just came out of left field for them and they appreciated it. That's how good wave happened for us. It came out of this experience. And we spoke about it and realized, hey, we've done this once. Would it be an absolutely crazy idea to try and just offer free therapy forever? And when you say it, it sounds unrealistic because how the hell are you going to do that? But that's when your teams come in. That's when perspectives come in. That's when people really rally together to make something happen. And we spent 1 year really putting the pieces of the puzzle together. because we now knew there was a need. It had been identified.
Yeah.
People needed it. People couldn't afford it. There was a gap to be filled. Mm. So let's try and see what we can do in this space to fill that gap. The biggest and only thing we needed here was money, because we had the pool of therapists. Going out and recruiting more was not a problem. I mean, we have a pretty stringent process for recruitment of therapists as well, in terms of their degrees, what qualifications they have or don't have, the kind of form that they fill, the interview that they go through. So that was the easy part. Getting people was the easy part.
Right.
It was the finance that was a little tricky. But the Goodway Foundation officially launched on the 7th of Jan 2022. And we started giving out free sessions sometime in June or July. It's been running on efforts of the team. So we've done a bake sale. We recently did a fundraiser for 3 days as well. The team put this together. It was absolutely brilliant. And that's how we raised money. And we were able to give out, I think, close to 570 hours of therapy over a period of 6 to 8 months.
That's a huge number, isn't it?
It's starting somewhere, and we don't see it stopping anytime soon. But for now, therapy is the only thing we are able to offer. Because it's only been a year since the foundation has been alive, so to speak. But now that the payment gateway is in place, there's a lot more that we can do in the mental health space. So I think free therapy is just the start for Goodway Foundation. There's a lot more on the agenda. And the person driving it for sure, Asif, is like I mentioned, also the founder of Never Grow Up, and very strong in terms of his passion for the space, what he would like to drive in the space. And the teams that work with us volunteer. And they give us their time because they believe in the cause. So it's phenomenal to see something come together. I mean, a Section 8 company come together because people believe in it. People still believe in it. So
because I can see two things here. The first is that how much it is needed. And especially in a country like India, which now, I mean, things have changed so much. It has gotten so much better. But still, like, being mental health being a taboo to people actually coming up and you seeing the need for therapy. And the second thing is that people being so giving and kind and, you know, very human in a way, that they are just volunteering and giving their time and efforts and even investing in other people's good.
Yeah, the best of people come out. And I don't think you have to be a therapist or be a mental health professional to work in this space. We have people working across operations, content, design. You don't need to have a degree in mental health to want to support the cause.
Now let's come to you in the workspace and how do you work in the work environment, because you have been working in well-being and mental health with organizations as well. So, you know, as the work environment is evolving so quickly, how is the mental health of people in the workspace, and especially with the younger generation coming, Gen Z coming in the workplace? How have you seen the change?
Man, Gen Z is incredibly vocal. They know what they want. As for I would say employers, you need to sit up and pay attention to that, because yes, I mean, it's something that's repeated often. They are the future. Of course they are the future. That's how generations work. But you don't sit up and pay attention to what it is they're saying, what they're asking for. Again, like, we're trying to be realistic about all of this. Listening is, I think, the most important part, whether it's an employee or an employer. Because yes, while Gen Z does have a voice, they are relatively new, and it also might make sense to take a step back and understand the current workspace and learn a bit about the organization and from the organization. So meet each other halfway, right? Rather than going at loggerheads and saying, oh, but we want this, and the organization saying just, no, we can't. Meet each other halfway and have maybe a cultural ambassador, culture ambassador, sorry, in between, who can advocate and who can be that gap. That's kind of where I would see work culture really changing in 2024 and mental health playing an impact in terms of people meeting each other halfway and not particularly having a hierarchy to it either.
I mean, what are the sort of challenges that you have noticed that organizations come across while they're trying to, you know, bridge that gap?
There's a lack of understanding of what is really required. The wrong questions are being asked. We are not asking what support do you need, or what does your day look like. We're not understanding each other's points of view. It's right now what I see is it's here and it's here. So you have people who are just entering the workforce coming with a certain set of ideals, which are completely justified and they're well within their rights to feel. And then you have people who've been in the workforce for quite some time. And the resistance there is very evident. So instead of maybe a resistance, building an understanding of the shortcomings of each generation, but also the positives of each. So I think only when you enter a space and you understand that you yourself come with shortcomings, the person opposite you comes with shortcomings, don't set the bar so high that nobody can reach it. Talk a little more. And when facilitating those conversations, try and make it as inclusive as possible. Diversity and inclusion was a buzzword last year. It's going to be a buzzword this year. But there are some very real steps taken in that direction to make it, I wouldn't say, I mean, it should be a priority anyway, but to make it the very fabric of an organization, to make it a part and parcel of a person's everyday. Because if they don't feel like they belong, they are not going to put their best foot forward. So companies need to stop expecting people to put their best foot forward if you are not treating them right. Please treat people correctly, treat people right, give them the resources they need to learn, to grow. And trust me, it will come back to you tenfold. I think sometimes mid-level managers just get squished in between because we don't know where we stand. And I've had this problem, and I'll be very frank, because working with founders and then you're also working with people who've just entered the workforce, it's a very strange, like, it's a spring, I would say, because mid-level managers then need training. We need a little more support. We need, I wouldn't say hand-holding, but some understanding of how the world of work has changed, what people are currently expecting, and tying that in with what the organization needs at the end of the day.
Got it.
So to answer your question, I mean, yes, those would be the gaps, but one of the simplest ways, well, call it simple, but one of the ways to fix it in a way would be a people-first approach. This is actually something, the first time I came across the term and actually saw it come to life was at Never Grow Up. Really putting your people at the center of it all. That doesn't mean, you know, your profits go out the window. But you're involving your people in the process. You're explaining to them what ground reality looks like for you as a founder. You're making yourself more human. And at the same time, your policies, your the way you treat people, your communication, your employee experience as a whole is so people-centric that people feel like they're coming to a workplace that actually cares. Not just about the bottom line, while that is important, but cares about you and how you feel at work, who you are at work, how you fit into that whole piece. So you're not just another employee number. You are somebody with your own thoughts, your own feelings, your own perspectives, and you are given the space to actually voice those out and see it come to life, see it be heard. Not every suggestion is taken because it's unrealistic, but every suggestion is acknowledged. Good, bad, ugly. So it's the little things.
Yeah, that's actually very interesting to me when you said profits not going out of the window. And with that, taking care or being as human as it can get as an organization. Meeting that point, how you as, you know, a well-being professional, how do you make that happen? What steps do you take? Or if you have some, you know, real-life instances that you can share?
I think one that comes to mind for sure is, again, I'm going to go back to diversity and inclusion here a little bit. Having innovative benefits, I would say, and really inclusive policies. Now, this doesn't mean making your policy sound inclusive from a language and tonality perspective. It's not what I mean. It's actually doing the work and revisiting a policy that was maybe written, I don't know, 10 years ago, because maybe that's when your business began. So if the world of work is changing, your policies need to be updated. While we don't expect a policy change every single year, the basics at least need to be met. Speaking of, I mean, the basics, one example that really comes to mind is parental leave in India. Now, it is it's a little controversial in terms of how many days, you know, should a parent get. And when you say parent, the only person that comes to mind is a mom. It's always a mother. It's very rarely, you know, you think of a father. Which again is our unconscious bias playing a role.
True.
We need to acknowledge that as well when it does happen. So it's mostly called a maternity policy. Some organizations do call it a parental policy and offer a different type of leave for a mother or a father.
Okay.
Sometime in 2021, we didn't have a policy for parents at Never Grow Up. And the world of work is changing. We need to do this, not just for ourselves, but for our people. Now, we are a very young workforce. So the reason we didn't have the policy at the time was everything else was in place. But because the workforce was so young, we didn't really have anybody having kids yet.
Got it, yeah.
Right? So it wasn't for a lack of wanting to have the policy. It was the need only wasn't really there. But we said, okay, fine, you know, rather than when the need arises, then scrambling to write a policy and you could probably make a mistake and it's rushed. We have some time. Let's do it. And we benchmark parental policies across the world to try and see what we could offer within an Indian setup. Do a completely genderless policy. Who is a parent? Define a man. Define a woman. Have you taken into account the LGBT community? And if your policy states man, states woman, aren't you kind of excluding a whole subset of people? We pitched for 6 months of paid leave for a new parent. You are becoming a parent for the first time, the second time possibly. Why should your experience as, and I'm going to use the word male here, be different from the birth giver, the mother? She is at home for a period of 6 months if her company allows it. And she's taking care of the child. As a father, you are being forced to come back to work after maybe 2 weeks of paid leave. And that's being generous. Some companies offer 2 weeks, some companies offer 5 days.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, the fact that they're offering any leave at this point is a blessing. So, you know, it's no point saying, oh, but
so
it's too
in
less.
India, still, it is not very commonly known as paternal leave.
It is, but it's not a mandate. So if you are a government employee, then you are licensed to 14, 15 days of paid leave. You are entitled to it. Sorry, not licensed, entitled to 14 days. Only if you work within a government setup. Private limited companies are under zero obligation to provide that.
Oh, God. Right. Okay.
So the policy currently stands where we offer 6 months of paid leave to any new parent. It also covers same-sex. It covers single parents. It covers foster parents. It covers any unfortunate incidents that could take place during pregnancy. Whether it's a miscarriage or it is an abortion. No questions asked, because you can't ask these questions. You,
of course, the person
is going through turmoil as it is. As a company, as an organization, as people, you try and stand by them and be there for them, and they don't need to worry about where their next paycheck is coming from. They know they have a job when they come back. They know they have a culture where they will be respected and valued the same way as when they left. Outside of that, work-life integration. I mean, most of the time it's called work-life balance, but when people say work-life balance, it just takes me back to the fish market and I see a balancing scale. It's not like the prettiest picture.
Yeah, yeah.
So work-life integration is, I think, where it's at. You're integrating your work and your life in such a way where it becomes a seamless, non-toxic blend. No one's asking you to integrate, you know, force fit your work and your personal life. But if work is so toxic, whether you like it or not, it's going to spill over into your personal life.
Yes, of course. Yes.
Then the scales are anyway not balanced. So
yeah,
integrating it, you know, in such a way where you have a hard stop and you say no to work on the weekends if your company, if that's what you've signed up for. But that also comes with, I believe, a lot of trust in your culture and being in the right space.
When you talk about work-life integration, corporates getting hybrid now.
Yeah.
That is a huge, huge thing to consider, because people, when they're working from home, there's no line between work and your personal life in this. How do you help organization to attain that work-life integration? And let's also, you know, talk from the perspective of different generations, because different generation needs different things. Because let's say somebody who is a millennial or Gen X would prefer stability so much more than a Gen Z would.
True, very true.
So how do you help organizations with that?
It's a good question. I think here as well, figuring out what your setup is in the first place. It's not nice, or it's not easy to kind of shift between the two. One minute you're saying, oh, we're hybrid, and people have settled with that idea. And the next minute you're saying, oh, come back to office 5 days a week. So you're not providing stability. Your people don't trust you anymore now, because you're saying one thing and doing the other.
Yeah.
While most of the time it's, oh, because the business needs it. We've all heard that. And I sympathize, because they're not wrong. The business genuinely does need it. But identifying those needs are important from day one, because people are also planning their lives around it. And after COVID, people felt a sense of control. And this is the positive sides of people started to feel a sense of control over their day while working from home.
Right.
They didn't have to commute. They didn't have to go into the office. They didn't have to do a lot of the quote-unquote normal things that they did pre-pandemic. It freed up their time. It gave them the opportunity to do something else, to pursue a hobby maybe, or to sometimes just do nothing. On the flip side, and I mean, an example that keeps coming to mind for me is, you know, when we say work from home looks different for different people.
Yeah,
for a fresher who lives with their family. If the family is supportive, great. Person's working from home and having a relatively productive day. But for somebody that does not come from a family where they are supported in general, being in that environment for 8 hours a day is the opposite of productive there, and it's not their fault. What happens to working women? Tons of women I spoke to during the pandemic very clearly said, we use our lunch break to put food on the table for the family, and then they eat within the last 10 minutes. So that lunch break for them and their workplace was for them. It was for them to catch up with their colleagues. It was for them to take a breather. But here, because they are in their own home, they are still expected to do the work.
Yeah, they're constantly working.
Constantly. So while work from home seems glamorous, it comes with its perks, and we've read like 1,000 articles on how working, you know, in your pajamas is the next big thing. But understanding your workforce, the demographics of it.
Right.
That would be the first step. Understanding who works for you, asking them what support they need. What is it that will help them be productive at work? What is it that they require in terms of a setup? Is hybrid okay for you? Is work from home okay for you? Would you prefer coming back to the office?
Right.
So anonymous people surveys, anonymous experience surveys of touch points at every stage. Whether it's an intern, or whether it's a fresher, or whether it's the CEO of the company, gathering that information from people and really paying attention to it. Only then can you make a real business decision. It can't just be, oh, you need to come back in office because we feel like productivity is dipping. Why is productivity dipping? Let's ask that question first. Are people working from home not feeling supported? Were they not given something as simple as reimbursements for their Wi-Fi?
Okay.
So something like a financial strain on now you're working from home, you're using your Wi-Fi 24/7. Your bills have gone up, your electricity has gone up, but the company is not stepping in to offer up any financial support for that. So now you're stressed about work and you're stressed about money, and you're supposed to be productive.
True.
So just asking the right questions, really leveling with your people. And here, I think, is where your HRBP comes in. Your people person, people and culture person comes in here to bridge that gap.
And how do you see, you know, AI and tech that is now so prominent? How do you think that it has impacted the, you know, human element in the work culture and even in the mental health? And how have you taken help, and how is it also impacted?
Got it. Okay. I'll take the work culture question first.
Okay.
For sure. I think from an employee perspective, it has genuinely freed up time. It has, and that's the truth of it, because something that would take you 2 hours to complete, for instance, now takes you 30 minutes with practice. And I say with practice because let's take ChatGPT, for example, now. Everyone's favorite AI tool to love and hate at the same time. Unless you give it the right prompt, you're going to get absolute rubbish from ChatGPT. And that's the truth of it, right?
Yeah.
So while it does free up time, how much of that time are you spending rewriting or rewording or so getting it right in terms of like the prompt? And this takes us back to the first like 15 minutes of this conversation where we talked about asking the right questions. You're seeking an answer, but you're asking the wrong question. So from a work culture perspective, I believe it truly has freed up time for people that know how to use AI ethically and are asking AI the right questions to solve very real-time problems.
Yeah, it's like human or AI, you have to ask the right questions.
Yeah, pretty much. You can rub it the wrong way and it's not going to give you what you want. It's helped in the decision-making process as well, for sure. Because right now, what I'm seeing happening is everybody has access to the internet.
Right.
I mean, that's a very common, fair, real statement to make. But with access to the internet, AI has leveled the playing field. Because right now, people have access to information that they maybe didn't have access to before. So by leveling the playing field in a sense, yes, with years of experience, you have amassed a sense of knowledge and a sense of purpose that AI will never be able to pick up on because you are human.
True. Yes.
But by leveling the playing field, AI has given people the opportunity to really throw themselves into the unknown. It's phenomenal in that space. So work culture, I would say, has undergone a slight shift in terms of how people are also looking at employment. They are asking questions during interviews like, what AI tools do you use?
Wow, that's great.
How is AI incorporated in the organization? To what extent? They want to know whether or not a robot is going to be making a decision for them during their performance appraisal. Or if it's going to be made by a real person. Incredible questions are coming up. Because it's possible. I mean, at some point, what if the entire performance appraisals, performance management system is automated? And by automated, I don't mean on a cloud-based technology. That's still run by a human being. You still have some interaction. What if you are just, your mid-year appraisal and your final year appraisal are conducted by a robot? What does that look like? So it's interesting to see the questions that are coming up, but companies need to definitely make note of people's concerns with AI. Jumping on the bandwagon of AI and subscribing to every tool doesn't benefit anybody. It doesn't make you a tech-first organization. It doesn't make you more attractive to clients or to potential employers. If you aren't completely sure how that tool is going to benefit your business and your people, unless there is a very real outcome on the mental health side, it's a lot murkier. It's I've also debated with myself a few times, back and forth, read up as much as I could, talk to peers in the field about how they feel, and we've got some very strong opinions on it being a complete no-no to AI being welcomed with open arms by professionals. There's no right or wrong. There genuinely is no right or wrong. It, to me, it's about recognizing the positive and the negative bits of it. Personally, I don't think in any reality AI will ever be able to replace a therapist 100%.
Yeah, absolutely.
In certain parts, you have AI-based therapy. You have people that are speaking to chatbots. And that's completely okay. Because it's a conversation at the end of the day. And yes, they are absolutely trained in terms of their algorithms to detect, to understand, to have these conversations. But on the good side of it, on the flip side rather, therapy is so much more accessible now for people that maybe can't afford the fees of an in-person therapist. So, for a person that can't go to therapy in person.
Yeah, that is true. And I mean, I agree on all the fronts that you're talking about. However, I was watching this these episodes of Black Mirror, if you know about.
I love the show.
Yeah, so do I. It's like almost reality, just the future things that are showing that they're showing in different episodes. And they had, you know, in one of the show episodes, they had shown that how, depending on the chatbots and the technology, the robots, for therapy, for a sense of belongingness, conversation, they become so much lonely with time and disconnected with the people.
Absolutely.
That humanizing and talking to a human is so much more important, because at the end of the day, we are social animals and we need warmth.
We are wired that way. Most of us are wired that way. And I'm not sure if you read about the recent loneliness epidemic. Apparently, people are incredibly lonely. It's not new information, but there's new research that came out, and I'm pretty sure I'll be very frank, I was scrolling through Instagram, and whether it was Harvard Business Review or one of the larger publications that published a piece on loneliness and how we are a very lonely generation. We're a very lonely population at the moment. And we live in the age of tech. We can do anything without moving an inch, and yet we are the loneliest people. And with AI in therapy especially, it's loneliness and isolation that plays in, and it's a very scary line to walk. But that's why going into it, you need to know the good and the bad. Now, this is very easy to say when you are not the person who needs that session, because I cannot for the life of me imagine somebody who's undergoing a severe depressive episode. They are not going to think about the positive and negative. They just want help. They just want support. They just want to feel heard. But on the other side, what happens when anxiety comes in? With AI, the one question everyone's asking and has been asking, I think, for a very long time in the tech in general is, how much about me do you know? What do you know about me? How much of my data is being tracked? And what are you doing with it? I don't think anybody wants the answers to these questions, because everybody will stop using their phones. It's scary.
Yeah.
We don't want to know, because what we don't know can't hurt us sometimes. And with AI in mental health and therapy specifically, you're putting somebody with, let's say, generalized anxiety disorder, somebody who has been diagnosed, having them speak to a robot, so to speak. And now they're worried about surveillance. They're worried about, they're scared, they're fearful. Yes, sure, these same concerns will come up in talking to a human. Are you going to tell anybody else? Oh my God, where is this going to go? Do you really want to help me? Very normal questions to come up in therapy.
Right, yeah.
But you don't have the answers with AI, because yes, your privacy policies will state it will go absolutely nowhere. But that's not always necessarily the truth, because how many of us read terms and conditions to the T? Very trusted organizations like WISA, I believe, have AI-led mental health care. And sometimes it's also the organization that you trust. But at the same time, trust is a fickle thing. I mean, the organization could genuinely be doing the most ethical thing possible. But that's the thing about mental health. You as a user, as a client, as a person who requires that support, your headspace can shift at any point. And catering to that need in real time, I think the human touch is undeniable in that space. And picking up on cues, understanding body language, AI is being trained to do all of these things. While there are people that would prefer to speak to a robot, fear of judgment, lack of ability to go and see a therapist in real time.
Right.
So many factors that play in. There are others that are just adamant about it and say, I will speak to a human or I will not speak to anybody. So there's no right or wrong. Honestly, it's about what you feel comfortable doing. And at the end of the day, what helps you sleep at night? Because isn't that all what we're trying to do, is just feel better, do better, eat better, live better. So honestly, at this point, whatever rocks your boat, whatever does help you. I think that's for me where it's at. I don't have a side that I can pick. I don't think there is a side you can pick. There are pros and cons to both. The con to human therapy is also very real. I read this incredibly shocking story on LinkedIn the other day, and I realized that yes, there are unethical practices in therapy for sure. She was in therapy, and she was talking to her therapist about problems she was facing in her marriage.
Okay.
Fairly normal conversation to have with your therapist. And the therapist asked her for photographic evidence from their bedroom.
What?
She wanted, or he or they, there was no revelation of the person or gender.
Yeah.
And she said, this is the client. She said, what do you mean? Why do you need this? She said, well, no, I do, because this is how I'm going to be able to help you. I need to see the problem. So the person just said, okay, that this is odd. Like, I'm not going to give you this information. And I believe she went and spoke to the person who wrote this post. So it happens. What if the person was extremely vulnerable and gave up that information, thinking, I will do anything to help myself and help my marriage. This is a professional. They are asking me for something. I have complete faith and trust in them. And therefore, I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
So ethics in therapy is also a constant battle for human beings. Because human beings also don't always have the right intent.
True.
Qualifications are, I think, the base of it.
Such incidents makes it all the more difficult for people to open up and to go to therapy, even if they have the intentions to get better and all good thoughts about therapy.
It's very scary. It genuinely is very scary. And
so now my last question to you would be, what would your dream work culture look like?
Oh my God. I think a culture that is clear, is real, and celebrates mistakes. I think at its core, people asking for respect. The way we communicate it, the way we tell somebody something, the way we make another person feel at work. I think that for me is an ideal culture, because Kritika, I'll be very honest with you. When respect is a two-way street, I have seen people go above and beyond in their jobs. My one answer to ideal culture would be respect. I think everything else is built around it. Your people are built around it. Your processes are built around it.
Thank you so much for sharing so candidly about your experience. And
thank you for having me. I really appreciate this. I think the questions that were asked, it took me on a journey as well. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
And there you have it. Another episode of Psych and Success, packed with insights and real-world advice on business psychology, Gen Z, evolving workplace dynamics, culture, AI, and so much more. If you want to stay ahead of the curve and dig deep into the fabric of modern work, you know what to do. Hit that follow button, share this podcast with your network, and drop us a review on Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you tune in. Your feedback not only supports us, but also helps us connect with more inquisitive minds like yours. By the way, if you're looking to get in touch with today's guest, I've got you covered. Check out the description for their contact details. And if you feel inspired to chat directly with me about these compelling subjects, you can book a quick call through my Calendly or shoot me an email. All the links are in the description. This is your host, Kritika Kashyap, reminding you that the future of work is here and it's evolving fast. So let's explore it together. Until next time.